This is Bob Fitrakis bringing you the other side of the news from WGRN 94.1, The People's Voice. And I'm privileged today to have an old friend of mine, Phil Nash, who teaches in the Asian Pacific American History, Art, and Public Policy courses at the University of Maryland, and also Asian American Legal Defense and Educational Fund staff attorney, among many other hats that we could get into. Also a prolific writer, been writing a lot of articles during the lockdown. Have you, Phil?
We got to do something, man.
Yes, but it's Hiroshima Day, and one I know you've thought long and hard about it, and in some ways, I think of it as the original sin. you're deliberately vaporizing people, and it's being done for political or political economic reasons. Was it not for military reasons?
Yeah, and you can tell because today in the New York Times, an article came out about a new book that's just been published by the University of Texas with the suppressed photos that were taken by Japanese journalists right after the bombings. And these photos were so horrific that the occupation forces of the United States did not allow them to be published in Japan or in the United States. After the U.S. left in 1952, the pictures have come out in Japan, but they still have not been released here. And I look at some of them today online, and you can go ahead and look at them. They are so horrific. I mean, just looking at a pile of bones where a school was, looking at people with burn marks on their bodies, looking at people carting their relatives around who have severe radiation burns. These were inhuman things that were done to hundreds of thousands of people. And like you say, it really is a beginning point for a new and horrific age of humanity, because this is something that was done to living people and hopefully it's not going to be done again. But as we talk about how nuclear power can be used or nuclear bombs can be used, I hope that every single lawmaker will stop and take a look at this book first and think about the horrific damage that was done and really think twice and three times before even considering something like that.
Now, how would you respond to the standard American support of dropping the bomb that, well, we had to, or a million men would have died invading Japan?
Well, that ties into the other topic that I was dealing with yesterday. The Japanese Latin Americans won a significant victory in the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights, which is part of the Organization of American States. And what the United States government was doing during World War II was trying to find non-white people that they could use in a hostage exchange with Japan so that they can get back their white GIs. And so what they were thinking of doing was taking Japanese Americans, including two-thirds American citizens by birth. And at the same time, they were scouring South America, Central America, looking for people of Japanese ancestry, some of whom had been there for a while, some of whom had become citizens of those countries, and essentially kidnapped them, brought them up here, took away their passports, then called them stateless citizens, held them behind barbed wire throughout World War II, and then afterwards used them in hostage exchanges. Some 8,000 people were sent back to Japan, even though many of them had never been to Japan. They had been living in Peru or Ecuador, other places. So what I'm trying to say is the U.S. government, when it deals with non-white people, has a very different standard. So whether or not we would have dropped an atomic bomb on Germany or Italy is a question that scholars need to ponder, because although, yes, it may have saved some lives of white American GIs, it also killed a lot of Asian people. And so again, you know, that's always a question scholars have to ask themselves, you know, would the same thing have happened if it had been in a majority white country?
Well, and also, I mean, Eisenhower and MacArthur both had problems with it. I mean, it's is it not a war crime? I mean, you're a scholar in this area, Phil. Well, is it not a war crime to drop on civilian centers any kind of bombs, let alone a nuclear bomb that will vaporize people?
Yeah, I mean, under today's standards, certainly it's a war crime. And that's why you say it's the beginning of an era, beginning of a discussion. There are many of us who don't feel it was justified, certainly not the second bomb. Even if you're going to say the first bomb is justified, that and then give them a week to think about it, look at it, and then certainly the Japanese Imperial Forces would have said, no, we're going to give up. But what happened was there were two teams that were creating these bombs, and they both wanted to have their products dropped so they could, you know, just do a test drive. And so they dropped the second bomb. And so in my mind, even if there is a justifiable reason you have the first one, there is zero justification of the second one. And that certainly was a war crime. But, you know, it is what it is. And now we're dealing with the last of the survivors. They call the Hibakusha, the people who actually suffered that damage. And they are still reminding us that we can never have another nuclear war and we need to get rid of all of our nuclear armaments.
Well, what was this event that went on yesterday that you were speaking of? What would you tell our listeners? Was it an actual ceremony or just a celebration for the victory?
Well, what happened was the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights, IACHR, is an agency that was set up in the 1950s to bring together all the different countries in the Western Hemisphere who are part of the Organization of American States. And it has a tribunal, this commission, that looks at instances where the U.S. violates the rights of its own citizens. And as you can imagine, there have been many. And while the United States likes to say, yeah, it's all those dictators down in South America, in this instance, it was a terrible situation that was caused by the U.S. government against these Japanese Latin Americans. I didn't finish the story. What happened was, so these people were kidnapped, brought up here, held behind barbed wire. Many of them were deported. And then after the war, Wayne Collins, a very dedicated American attorney, helped some of them to not be deported. And instead, they went to work for Seabrook Farms in the frozen food industry. This is the beginning of the frozen food industry after the war. And the reason, one of the reasons why it took off and was successful was because this cheap labor of these hardworking Japanese Latin Americans came and they worked and helped to get that business started. And then afterwards, when there was a movement for redress that I and many other Japanese Americans brought, we were successful in getting legislation passed in 1988. That said that Congress was going to give $20,000 to each of the people who were still alive, approximately half of the $120,000. And at the same time, they were going to get an apology from the president. They were going to get a fund that was going to, you know, pay for good works and scholarly research. But the Japanese Latin Americans were not allowed to participate in this. The legal term is they were not here under color of law, meaning they weren't citizens, they were stateless. I mean, essentially the U.S. had taken their passports when they are en route from Lima or some other country in South America, brought them here, separated the fathers from the children. So again, it's very similar to the way we're treating some of the people coming up from Central and South America right now. So that's why this major victory in the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights is a big deal. It's a case that was filed 17 years ago saying that the U.S. did not give equal redress to these people compared to what they gave to the Japanese Americans. And they also have not released the records that show exactly what happened, because many of these people, like what happens even now, I mean, terrible things happen and you can't get the records to show what happened. And autocrats like President 45 and his minions, they block subpoenas, they do things to prevent records from coming out. And then they say, well, nah, you can't prove we did anything. So that's the way that autocrats have done it since time immemorial. And that's what the U.S. government did back in the 1940s. So this victory says the Organization of American States is putting their imprimatur behind this and saying, hey, U.S., you better talk to these Japanese Latin Americans, you better give them some redress, and you better give them their documents. And like I said, it's a tremendous victory for all of us who care about human rights, and particularly for those who are seeing children separated from their parents by ICE, who are seeing unlawful detentions, who are seeing actions in Portland where unmarked cars are coming, taking people off the streets. These types of actions should not have been done back in the 1940s, and they certainly shouldn't be done now.
Well, you are listening to WGRN, and you get to hear Professor Phil Nash, who teaches Asian Pacific American history, art, public policy, and courses, and is a man of many hats. So this is WGRN again, 94.1, The People's Voice. You had an article out recently that was, I thought, quite interesting, saying essentially we're all immigrants now. For the record, was it Trump that made us all immigrants? Or was it Trump and the pandemic? Why are we all immigrants?
Oh, well.
My dad was first generation, so I'm with you. I mean, I see immigrant as a good word. You know, my yaya lost three people during the, my grandmother during the 1919 pandemic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, in my article, I talk about how my grandfather, Misao Tajitsu, came over from Japan, and I looked at the different things that he experienced during his life. And what I saw was that he went through not a steady state situation where he stayed and became naturalized and got a job, got married. You know, we have this notion that people live these lives, they just kind of go up the curve, and at the end, everyone's happy, and we have 2.6 children, and we've got a home all paid for. And, you know, that's not the way a lot of people's lives go, and particularly given what's happened in the last few years and the last few months. So what I have seen with his life and what I'm seeing now is something that the geologists refer to as punctuated equilibrium. And what that means is you have a steady state situation that goes on for a long period of time, and then during a period of great change, you see tremendous, tremendous differences from the previous situation. Obviously, the geologists are talking about geologic scale of time, but many social scientists are also seeing this as a way to look at some of the changes we see in human generation time. And so what we're seeing now is because of the virus, because of the economic changes, because of the Black Lives Matter movement, we're seeing tremendous challenges to the way society has been established and the way that white male patriarchy has been here. And so what I'm seeing is that all of us are in a period of indeterminacy. None of us have certainty in terms of our employment, in terms of the way we dealt with social relations, in terms of housing, in terms of anything else. So frankly, this is a type of dislocation and uncertainty that immigrants and refugees deal with all the time. All of us are dealing with that uncertainty. Even if you have white male privilege, you don't have the certainty that you think you have being a 14th generation white Anglo-Saxon Protestant. You just don't. So all of us are going to have to deal with that indeterminacy. And what I'm advocating in the article is that all of us have to be kinder to each other. All of us have to think about ways we rebuild the society and rebuild our values, rebuild our relationships so that we can have a little bit more justice and a world where we don't have unfair privileges for any group of people.
Well, I was thinking about that when I was looking at the article. But one of the things, and we got about 10 minutes left, one of the things, they had a chart. The United States was the only country, particularly advanced country, where people actually have lost healthcare in a pandemic. Yeah. Exactly when you need it, a basic right. I mean, not in Canada, not in virtually any place on earth where they have universal healthcare, but we're actually, our public policies appear to be harsher and more vicious when you're calling for the exact opposite, more compassion. Can we get to the, you know, holy grail of, you know, healthcare for everyone? You'd think at least you'd get it in a pandemic, wouldn't you?
Well, unfortunately, you look at the Democratic Party platform, they have not put in healthcare for all, Medicare for all in there. I guess they figure that even the Bernie people are going to have to accept Joe Biden, and so we'll just put up with anything we want. But this is really a time when everyone should see the merits of having a Medicare for all situation. And I'm hoping that that's going to change. And I'm hoping that Biden and the Democrats will put that in power if they can beat President Trump.
Yeah. And it's beyond compassion. I mean, I like the thought it's driven by compassion, but it's sound policy. Do you really want poor people without health care in a pandemic that are at risk to spread a virus? You would think you would want to test them and treat them and cure them and make sure that everything's stable. I saw also you were writing, Ferrer, you were speaking about the pedagogy of the oppressed. What is it, the pandemic that has you reflecting in terms of, you know, these great, great writers? I'm thinking Fanon, The Wretched of the Earth, and others that wrote about this question of oppression. How should we think about oppression, particularly with the public policies going on in the U.S. right now?
Well, I think the pandemic has given us all more time to think and reflect. Some of us from the pre-internet era actually remember how to read. So I took a book away from propping open my door and started reading it this morning. And just kidding. But, you know, as I look back on some of these writers and look at some of the things that they dealt with, Paulo Freire and others got us to think about how we analyze our world and how we question the way that education is working. Because what Freire said was the education system in most developed countries is what he referred to as a banking system, where we just take coins of knowledge and deposit them in your head, and then you spurt them back out again and get an A on the test. And you're not taught to critically analyze the world around you. Freire would say, don't just repeat, you know, Dick and Jane go up the hill. He would say, why do Dick and Jane's parents have less money than Joe and Mary's parents? And why do these workers have less job opportunities and health insurance than those workers? And start to think critically about the world around you. So I think we need to start to take a lead from Freire and others, because we're redoing our whole education system. We're taking things online. We're having new ways of approaching not just social distancing, but everything. And so why not reanalyze the whole way we educate people, including putting some critical analysis into our day-to-day tools that we give our children?
So why is Jane on the sideline looking at Dick running and Spot running, but not running?
Well, that's unfair male privilege. But
So what are you going to be working on next?
Well, I'm going to follow up some more with these Japanese Latin Americans. By the way, if anybody wants to read more about this, you can go to JLACampaignForJustice.org. JLACampaignForJustice.org.
That's, I mean, it's a fascinating story. I mean, you've clearly met some of these people. I mean, literally, they were kidnapped by the U.S. government.
Yeah, and see, and that's what make it so compelling and so relevant to what's happening today. I'm also working with another group called Tsuru, T-S-U-R-U. Tsuru means crane in Japanese. And these people, if you just Google the word Tsuru for justice, you will see this group that is trying to protest and close down these ICE detention centers. Because we Japanese Americans, either personally or through our parents and grandparents, saw the injustice of this, and we don't want it happening to young refugees and immigrants from Central and South America. So there's plenty to do to try and stop or slow down the injustice. And obviously, we all should vote and help to change the people who are controlling the levers of power in this country. And then even after we get the Democrats in, we have to make sure we push and make sure they do the right thing when it comes to Medicare for All and other issues.
Well, I co-wrote an article with Harvey Wasserman, but I mean, they had 1,000 people at the Capitol in Ohio, far right, heavily armed, who felt a sense that they're, they were being discriminated against. Have you thought, I mean, they scared the hell out of me. I was thinking late Weimar Republic, because not only were all the men armed, all the women had were packing pistols as well. And, you know, this sort of sentiment, you reflected on where that comes from and, you know, why it's directed towards other people?
Well, I think you can certainly see a double standard here, because when peaceful Black Lives Matter protesters are sitting in front of police officers, they get clubbed and arrested. And these heavily armed right-wing people can yell in the face of the police or do terrible things and nothing happens to them. Now, fortunately, the New York State Attorney General has just brought an action today against the NRA, and they're going to get them defunded because they are not a non-for-profit. The things that they've been doing have been influencing elections, and they certainly should not get the privilege of having people donate to them and get a tax write-off. So that's going to do a good job at helping to clip their wings a little bit, and then hopefully we'll be able to deal with other issues.
Well, again, Professor Phil Nash, longtime humanitarian and human rights leader in the country, our staff attorney with the Asian American Legal Defense and Educational Fund. In the last 2 minutes, anything you'd like to tell the listeners, the other side of the news? What should they be looking for as part of that, those other news stories we should be concerned with?
A new study has just come out from McKinsey, the polling group, talking about the Asian Pacific Americans and the impact of COVID. And it's very interesting because President Trump and others are talking about the Kung flu, and you're trying to drum up this anti-Asian sentiment. And what has happened is, Asian Pacific Americans are about 20 million people, about 6% of the U.S. population. About 2 million own small businesses. They generate about $700 billion in annual gross domestic product and employ about 3.5 million people. But what's interesting is they are suffering a lot more than the rest of the population in terms of their businesses, in terms of mental health issues, in terms of unemployment. McKinsey estimated there's a 450% unemployment of Asian Pacific Americans between February and June, as opposed to the rest of the population. They found that the Asian Pacific Americans disproportionately are facing contact with COVID, dying at a rate about twice as high as others. So there's a lot of things that Asian Pacific Americans are suffering, and I hope that your listeners will check out that McKinsey report. And also go to the Asian American Legal Defense Fund, ALDEF.org, ALDEF.org, and there's more you can read about Asian Americans there.
All right, we're out of time. I appreciate your time, Professor Phil Nash, and my good friend. It's always great to see you.
Thank you.